Hello, this is GW. Today we're going to do a final part. It might not be a final part, but let's call it such.
Part three.
On the question, it's part three. Thank you for that, Daniel. On the question of Brexit and the political significance of the events, which have been moving very fast over the last few hours in this country. And we'll see whether we can't fish out of it all some interesting viewpoints from a nationalist perspective. I have with me, as ever, Daniel and Kamika. And the place to start is probably a reprise of the events that have occurred since the sole remaining candidate opposing Theresa May, present to Home Secretary, Andrea Leadsom, I'm not too sure how we should pronounce that, gave up. She gave up because she'd been put under immense media pressure, owing to some comments she'd made about the nature of motherhood or childlessness, depending on how you want to read it. And these comments were taken by the media across the board as being, quote, vile, unquote. And she's thrown the cards in, and that has the effect of making Theresa May the elective Prime Minister of Great Britain. And she's expected to take that role up over the course of the next 48 hours or so. We should look at, probably first of all, the concentration of the media on the vileness of Mrs. Leadsom's comments and what that tells us about the whole process. First of all, were they actually vile? And there's two or three ways of looking at this. Kamiko and I probably have opposing ways of looking at it. Kamiko, could you explain your own standpoint on what she had said?
Okay, and what she actually said is, according to the transcript, Rachel Sylvester asks, what is the main difference between you and Theresa May? And Leadsom responds, quote, in terms of the country, I think I absolutely understand how the economy works and can really focus on turning it around. In terms of personal qualities, I see myself as one, an optimist, and two, a huge member of a huge family. And that's important. My kids are a huge part of my life. My sisters, my two brothers who are half brothers, my mum and stepdad's sons who are very close, huge part of a family, so very grounded and normal, enormously optimistic. Sylvester then asks her, does your family inform your politics? Leadsom responds, oh, totally. Sylvester, during the Euro debates, you said several times, quote, as a mum. Do you feel like a mum in politics? Leadsom then responds, yes. Sylvester asks, why and how? And this is the part where, you know, she says the thing which then started to make mileage in the media. So Leadsom responds, so really carefully, because I am sure I don't really know Theresa very well, and I'm sure she will be really sad she doesn't have children. So I don't want this to be, quote, Andrea has children, Theresa hasn't, end quote, because I think that would be really horrible. But genuinely, I feel being a mum makes you have a very real stake in the future of our country, a tangible stake. She possibly has nieces, nephews, lots of people, but I have children who are going to have children who will directly be part of what happens next. So really, it keeps you focused on what you are really saying, because what it means is you don't want a downturn, but never mind, 10 years hence, it will all be fine. My children will be starting their lives in that next 10 years, so I have a real stake in the next year, the next two, end quote. At this point, of course, the media completely exploded at her because appeared she had drawn a dividing line between herself and Theresa May on the basis that she has a different perspective on life, I guess a more attentive short-term perspective, because of the fact that she has children, whereas Theresa May has none and is incapable of having any. And so it would then be portrayed as both mean-spirited and a kind of ideological pseudo-battle between women, because on one hand, she's making the point that having children gives you some kind of positive aspect, which Theresa May is lacking. And then there's also the fact that even if Theresa May wanted to imitate Leadsom, she would not be able to because she's unable to have children. And so it was then taken as an ideological challenge and mean-spirited at the same time. Even though she had said at the beginning that she didn't want it to be taken that way, it's kind of weird for her to come out and say, okay, I don't want you to take it this way, but genuinely, here it is. Mm. It'd be almost like if I were to say, I'm not going to insult you, but here is the insult. Right in a package here, yes. In a box.
I'm not quite sure about that. I think that she was struggling to find the words that describe an actual fact of human experience, human nature, human aging, which is not controversial, nor should it be. It's something which everybody who's had children would understand very well from first-hand experience. And anybody who says otherwise is lying for political reasons, very likely, within the context of this debate. But it's not easy, even for somebody who's sat down and mulled about it for a minute or two, to find exactly the right words to express that. It's probably easier for people like us, who spend lots of time trying to work out such subtle matters, but politicians aren't really like that. They're not really thinkers at all. So when they're confronted with something that they've actually got to plumb into and measure carefully and come out with some definite truth, are more apt to, as they say these days, misspeak. And perhaps she did misspeak, but the thing about it is that nobody gave her the benefit of the doubt, not in the media. Nobody was prepared to say, well, she's trying to say this, and yes, of course, I mean, I'm a parent too, and certainly change me. Nobody's prepared to give her that kind of benefit. And the result has been that she's been subjected, in fact, to the very opposite of benefit of the doubt, which is an absolutely certain prosecution of her moral nature. And it's cut her legs off. It's left her shocked and unable to defend herself. Now, you may you know, if she's going to do that job, she has to be able to take that.
To weather this, yes. I thought that she was going to be able to pull through it as well. I didn't see how large the backlash was going to be. I thought, oh, she's just going to walk straight through that, though.
Yeah.
You know, no matter how much we yell or do not yell at her, I figured she was just going to walk through it. That was the thing that I found strange about this. Like, you know, I was on, you know, me and you are not exactly on the same side on this, on what the meaning of what she said was, or whether people should have taken offense to it or not. But, well, first, I should say what the two sides are, because we're talking about two sides here. One of the sides seems to be natalist, and the other side seems to be anti-natalist. For the first time in, like, I think, British media ever, suddenly all of British media was suddenly on the anti-natalist side in order to spite Andrea Leadsom. I found that to be strange, because I've never actually seen the British media on the anti-natalist side until just now. Usually, if you say, oh, you know, you don't necessarily need children, the entire media will jump on you, all of the red top newspapers will jump on you, Sky News will jump on you, and so on and so forth. Now, in the Leadsom case, she comes out and says, yeah, you know, having children gives you a special perspective or whatever it is. Suddenly the entire media is like, actually, you're wrong. But if any other person had said that, they would not have responded in the way they
wrong,
did, because usually they say the opposite.
You are vile.
Yeah, because I think from my perspective, what Leadsom said was I would say mildly annoying. But I don't think it rose beyond that level.
No. The fact that it's uniform and that nobody was willing to say, hang on, actually, human beings, you know, what's going on? Why would anybody think that having children doesn't somehow broaden your experience or give you an investment in the future that's no longer notional but is absolutely definitively there in the flesh every day? You know, these things are so clear, and ordinarily amongst certain people, you know, they're not something that needs to be debated at all. They're self-evident. So how come all of that?
It also started to look.
It also set aside.
It also started to look strange because it was almost like they were advancing the argument without the nuances it usually contains. Because usually, if someone brings an anti-natalist argument, they will not deny that having children confers something onto the person which the person who does not have it has. But the fact that the media suddenly decided it was going to deny even this, thus taking the argument into the realm of non-reality, was strange as well.
Right.
And so I always find that whenever I find that an argument that ordinarily I would agree with has been taken into the realm of non-reality, I start to ask, who is doing that and why are they doing it?
Right.
You know, putting it straight, I am an anti-natalist, and I don't think that the argument was being made by the media was the right one to have brought to her. I would have said to her, if I were having this conversation with her, I would have said to her, yes, I'm sure it does confer, you know, certain effects which are different. My question would be is, how do those things make her more suitable for leadership? But the media was not even interested in his nuance. Strangely enough, no one in the media came to her defense either, because usually when you have two sides of a boxing match, there should be the other side, right? But the other side was simply not present.
It was not there, no.
Even within you know what is usually associated as a centre-right media, which is usually pro-natalist, none of them came to her defence. Even the Sun did not come to her defence. The Daily Mail did not come to her defence. And that is the strangest thing I've ever seen, because from as far back as I can remember, the Daily Mail has always been pro-natalist.
Absolutely. So this was a, if not an ordered event in the terms of it being ordered from above, it was an ordered event in the terms that it was orderly and singular. So it's reasonable to assume that the people who agreed to it being cast in this way were editors, because they choose what kind of material they're going to publish. And
presumably,
if I don't know, some journalist somewhere had produced a motherhood and apple pie type of article, or if somebody had produced a psychologically reasoned argument, you know, on evidential bases and so on and so forth, those things did not get into print.
Exactly, they would not have made the final cut.
They did not.
And I think there's a connection between editors of newspapers and political establishment in this sense. And so when Leedsom gave the response that I read off, where, you know, they finally got her in that position to get her to answer the question, and she did, as soon as she did that, they may have thought to themselves, aha, could this damage her sufficiently? And then it kind of, you know, gained traction until it did.
Okay, so looking into
because
this,
they must have all been out for her, because I think that I think that generally speaking, most of the media and the political establishment, the Tory party, already wanted Theresa May. So yes. If Leedsom does something that looks like it could become a mistake, and I put place mistake in quotation marks, of course, if it looks like she's doing something that could become a mistake, then it's kind of like wolves closing in for the kill then, right? Not necessarily a conspiratorial
Let me just float another aspect of this, which is Theresa May's behaviour during the referendum.
Okay.
This is somebody who had presented herself during most of her life, political life, as being a Eurosceptic.
Mm-hmm.
There is a very strong element of Euroscepticism in the party. In the country, the Conservative Party. And she'd had a long practice of going around associations. She's somebody who's done quite a lot of that, from association to association, dinners and so on and forth, you know, fetes, whatever they do, charity events, and giving speeches. She has done that. And she's tended to always curry favour at that level. But when push came to shove and choices had to be made in the referendum, she disavowed the Euroscepticism which she'd always promoted to the party at large, and sought to presumably protect her standing within the government and her loyalty to David Cameron, and disappeared into the Remain faction. And thereupon, as is now become quite common, so she hid behind the sofa. That's what they say. She did not campaign. So this is somebody who had alienated her supporters, if she'd got any, in the Brexit part of the equation. And then, having joined the other part of the equation, she actually did nothing. Everybody's went out and made speeches. You know, Philip Hammond at the Foreign Office, he went out, he made speeches to empty halls and was photographed, you know, donutted by people with placards saying better off in and this sort of thing. They all did their bit, apart from Theresa May, who was invisible. You would have expected that she would have had quite a lot of people within that particular faction saying, well, bloody hell, woman, you didn't do anything for us, did you? And we damn well lost. If you'd have pulled your weight, we might have got there. But apparently she's able, nonetheless, without any real reason for having any support at all, to present herself as a candidate for the office of Prime Minister. And nobody raises a word against her. On the contrary, they all start inching towards her because they sense that this is the establishment candidate, and that whatever she's done, or whoever she is, or however well she's performed in the past, whatever her real beliefs might be, because nobody knows, she would be the one to get close to. So then you get this appalling spectacle, people like Liam Fox, for example, who presents himself as being really right-wing and really Eurosceptic, you know, really one of the big hitters of Euroscepticism, saying, I'm backing Theresa May. You get David Davis, who's one of the few people in the party who one would expect to have moral principle because he's displayed it in the past. I'm backing Theresa May. You think, well, what the hell is going on? What's going on is that the establishment is revealing itself. The establishment is revealing itself. And what we saw with this business with this Times journalist, Sylvester, and the attack on Andrew Leadsom was the establishment, once again, revealing itself. The phrase I used earlier today elsewhere, the establishment re-electing itself, is what it's done. So we've been through this process. The establishment was beaten. It got knocked back. It has had to find a way of finessing itself back into a position of authority and power. It does not have moral authority, however, and it may well be that that will become quite significant over the course of the next few years.
Yeah.
That's my view of this whole thing, really.
I'd say that while it is an establishment play, it seems to be a different tenor that they're bringing to the situation. Now, if you remember from way back, people were saying, you know, can Theresa May eventually be the next prime minister? And the answer to that question back then, perhaps, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, was a resounding no. And the reason was because, you know, she wasn't part of that inner circle of people who did philosophy, politics, economics as a quote-unquote degree at Oxford. She wasn't part of any of those things. She was a complete outsider to those things. And so in a sense, she's almost like establishment, but she's the establishment that had not actually been able to assert itself because of that core of other establishment people who were, you know, holding the positions. Mm. And so I wouldn't be as cynical as to say that Theresa May is complete establishment in the sense that she's identical to David Cameron or something like this. She is clearly different from him, and she was not able to act under her own capacity during the time that she was Home Secretary because she never had the autonomy to do whatever she wanted to do.
This is what she said this morning. She gave a speech which is very well received, and she was talking about about her social views. She was thought by Peter Hitchens, by the way, to be a Blairite. This is a different kind of conservatism, I know. It marks a break with the past, but it is in fact completely consistent with conservative principles, because we don't just believe in markets, but in communities. We just don't believe in individualism, but in society. We don't hate the state. We value the role that only the state can play. We believe everybody, not just the privileged few, has a right to take ownership of what matters in their lives. Yes. We believe that each generation of politicians, of business leaders, of all of us, are custodians with a responsibility to pass on something better to the next generation. Above all, we believe in Britain and in the British people. Well, you know, it's
PAP. That sounded very nice.
It's PAP. You know, utter, total PAP. What on earth does that tell us about this woman's principles? What does it tell us? Oh, we're going to be more socially inclusive. We're going to be like New Labour. Is that what she's trying to say?
I can surmise two things from that. The first thing is that she is not the second coming of Margaret Thatcher, but I never would have expected her to be. And also, it seems as though, you know, she must be an avid reader of the Fabian Society, because this is the precise position which they are presently holding at their website. And I say that without condemnation. I say that as just an objective observation, that she sounds very much like them.
Yeah, so there's
but
no
I think,
change.
I think that's because there's been a kind of meeting of the minds at the centre, where I think sides of the British political spectrum have sort of come to an agreement that the Fabian Society was right all along, quote unquote.
I think that those words might as well be generated by, you know, like some sort of standard discourse computer. Okay, so what does she actually say? Nothing. She didn't say a damn thing. If you can try to look at the general shape of the entirety of it, it might be socially progressive. Well, that's a surprise, because when Cameron came in, what did he do? Gay marriage. I mean, what's new? There's nothing.
Well, she supported that. She also supported that.
Mm. Yeah, these are just people who follow whatever dictate comes down from wherever it comes from. And
at the time, they would have believed one thing, and then later on, they believed a different thing.
Oh, but it's totally craven. I was more or less a supporter of Margaret Thatcher because I believed that she, as an individual politician, always wanted to do much more than she'd been able to do. She was always embattled against this blob, which somehow or other was wrestling with her to enforce its internationalism and progressivism on her as a social conservative, really patriotic, I suppose, prime minister. So I did support her because she was closer to what I believe in myself, naturally enough.
Do you think that she would make the same? Do you think she would make the same call on Section 28 today if she lived now as she did back then?
I think she was.
I don't think she would.
But I would be open to persuasion on that. But just to finish with this little story, remember the day Major was out of office. Everybody knew it was going to happen. It was always clear that Blair would be elected. Major was incredibly unpopular. He didn't have a hope of winning the election in 1997. The very moment that happened, the Daily Telegraph, which was supposed to be the record of the, you know, the Conservative Party in the nation. It was supposed to be
they
completely changed everything, and overnight it became a socially progressive organ. It happened immediately.
To see how that happened, you have to think of it in a Gramscian way, that before a class actually takes power, it has to lead in society before it takes place. While it may appear that these organizations suddenly turned on their head and became socially progressive on these issues, it was because all of this stuff had been bottled up by the fact that society had changed already about 3 or 4 years previously, but it had yet to find this expression politically. And so once Tony Blair stepped through the door of number 10, then suddenly the dam was taken down, the water flowed out that had been building up behind the scenes the whole time. That's how I think it went. You could see it at that Prime Minister's Question Time. Up on YouTube, Tony Blair gets up almost like a wolf hunting sheep, walks around the dispatch box and then says to him, you know, there's one very big difference between me and you. Yeah, there's one very big difference. I lead my party, you follow yours.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
I remember that particular saying.
Yeah, that was the moment. I think that was the moment when it was over. At that point, it was over.
It was a sudden change in Time magazine as well in the States. That always seemed like a fairly conservative magazine, and one day it was quite liberal, very liberal. GW, I think you might be overrating her a bit in her role in history.
Thatcher.
That she may have been opposed by the Marxist brand of YKW interests, but that she was being steered by the neoliberal brand of YKW interest, which was founded in the Austrian school, before the Austrian school of economics would have been founded in the Austrian school of logical positivism, which was based on Wittgenstein's Tractatus Logico Philosophicus. Now, Wittgenstein was trying to carry to its logical conclusion the sort of empirical worldview, the Locatine worldview. This was an aspiration of Russell and Whitehead. And
You don't even have to switch.
But
no, go on.
Okay, yeah. But the later Wittgenstein came to be embarrassed by this program.
Even
he spoke of the author of the Tractatus as if it was someone else.
This was after his gardening period.
This was after becoming apprised of not only non-Euclidean geometry, but the Gödelian principle, the uncertainty principle of Heisenberg, Niels Bohr's, all these things, the hermeneutics project of Heidegger, and how he was trying to take the postmodern turn away from the Cartesian project, were ahead of where Margaret Thatcher was going on. I think that Margaret Thatcher, like Reagan, was being used by these neoliberals to an extent to create a kind of false opposition and a false conservatism.
I would not go that far. I think that what happened in this case was, you don't have to go back very far to figure out that, you know, she was very influenced by the Austrian school, because they found her sitting on a bench reading a book by Friedrich August von Hayek in the first place. So, I mean, he was an Austrian school economist. She was reading him from the start.
Yeah.
And so, but this should not be seen.
Yeah,
I don't think this should be seen, but you're not letting me finish.
That she's not being influenced by it. Hayek was the cousin of Wittgenstein and very much in line with that program.
Of course. I'm not saying that it contradicts what you're saying. I'm saying that that's just the easier way of figuring it out, the fact that she's literally reading them. So you don't have to, like, you know, do a big investigation to find this.
I didn't say it was a big mystery, but, you know, she was being encouraged, both directly and indirectly, to create a false conservatism. She was really...
What she was doing was liberalism. No,
like,
yes, of course she was, obviously, but I'm saying this is not a conspiracy in the usual sense of the term, that they weren't thinking to themselves, mwahaha, we're going to do a false sense of conservatism here. Because by that, anything that was going on in Britain was obviously going to be suffused with liberalism, because this is where liberalism came from in the first place. But what was happening in the case of Thatcher was that was their only way out. It was their lucky way out, and I'll explain why. During the 60s and the 70s, there was this move toward having what you saw manifest under Harold Wilson, which was, nationalization of companies, then being, unfortunately, run inefficiently, because, unions were doing constant strikes despite the fact that they were, ostensibly getting everything that they wanted. British unions were not behaving in a responsible fashion. And so it came down to a point where Harold Wilson was in power, and the MI5 was putting out black propaganda, much of which was entirely justified. But, there's such a thing as having, excessive black propaganda. And so they had reached a point of excessiveness where they were believing their own black propaganda, on top of the fact that Harold Wilson was already presiding over a very bad situation. You know, Britain's economic power was looking pretty awful. The winter of discontent was happening, stuff with the IMF getting a bit irate, all of this kind of thing. And so in the background, the defense sector and I guess you could say the military and so on had already had contingency plans in place. That was going to be a national government of salvation if nothing could be done to resolve this problem. And that in this national government of salvation, the first action would be to shut down Heathrow Airport, essentially have, I guess, what you could call a soft coup, after which Lord Mountbatten of Burma would be selected as the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, and then there'd be a tack to the right. However, that's very inconvenient. British people are not the kind of people who are very fond of having military coups inside of their country. So, everyone was told to wait. And so you're constantly waiting to see whether it's going to be Harold Wilson eventually being replaced by someone else, or whether it would actually end up in a real coup scenario and not just people talking about it. And so, private armies were being raised up apparently in secret. The BBC had revealed this one as well. So when I say this, it's not just me saying it and telling you to take my word for it. Private armies were being raised up and all kinds of things for the contingency in the case of the country should happen to collapse after the winter of discontent. Of course, as we know, that reality did not play out. Instead, Margaret Thatcher appeared onto the scene, and they thought to themselves, wait, what if Margaret Thatcher were to become Prime Minister and were to enact all of the things which the coup government would have done without having to actually have a coup? Very conveniently, she was reading von Hayek, and she was, a free marketeer.
Very conveniently. That's where you would accurately characterize what I would say was probably happening.
What I'm simply saying is that how it went, but it was not a conspiracy, and I can explain to you why it was.
I didn't say it was.
The reason was because they didn't want her to be Prime Minister in the first place. Within the Tory party, there was always these two different strands, and she was a new strand that had appeared, because historically, the Tory party was never, in fact, about the strains of individualism and so on that had been so strong in Thatcher's approach to things. The things which Thatcher brought to the party had been more the preserve of the Liberal Party back in the early 1900s, and the emergence of Thatcher was the final triumph of full total liberalism over what had been a corporatist Tory party before. And so the triumph of that was like a window in history, I think that window essentially came to a close with the emergence of these people like David Cameron and so on. And I think it remains closed with the arrival of May, because Theresa May is not the second coming of Thatcher. She's actually a continuation. It would make more sense to compare Theresa May to Michael Heseltine than it would be to compare her to Margaret Thatcher. Mm. So all of that was essentially just me getting to that point.
Okay, now you brought it up to date. Ledson could be seen as being a Thatcher light, some people referred to her, and people who said, oh, she's not a Thatcher light, but she is a social conservative, which Thatcher was. She is looking probably at a rather economistic politics, which Thatcher did. Mm-hmm. So there's some similarities, and of course she's an embattled woman, so there was that too. And mm-hmm. she was not a favourite. She'd come from nowhere without any
exactly.
real heavy experience. So those were the, and she has a certain visual similarity to her, you know, blonde.
Yes.
So there was something to be said with that, although
yeah.
it might seem to be a bit superficial. The big difference is that Thatcher came with a group, which included Ian Gow, by the way, who was murdered by the IRA in Eastbourne at his home.
Oh, yes, yes.
And included Airey Neave, who was murdered before she could take up office. He was killed at Westminster in driving out of the car park. His car had a bomb attached to it. It included Keith Joseph, who was the person who introduced her to the Austrian School Economics. It yeah. included Alfred Sherman. And it included
yes.
William Whitelaw, who was her political mentor. And it was these people, and by the way, Sherman was also her route, particularly her route into Jewry, and the great support that she enjoyed from, you know, North London Jews. She was immensely
See?
Popular with
them. Mm-hmm. And
she was very close also to Jacobowitz, who was the chief rabbi at that point.
But that just goes to show that the left is not yeah. her only enemy, because, you know, they are on
both sides,
other
yeah,
than
sure,
the left
sure.
as well.
So, but she came with this entourage around her, supporting her, proposing her, giving her credibility.
Whereas Leadsom lacks this
alone,
entirely.
Totally alone. She's been subjected to this vast coordinated attack, and she collapsed. She didn't have
yeah.
anything. Whether Leadsom yeah. will be taken up by somebody in the future and be turned into something, be made, you know, created as a rounded politician with an ideology that can seize control of the times is possible.
Yeah.
But in my view, for that to have happened, it required quite a lot.
More input from others, yeah.
Input from others. And, you know, when you look at the Brexit camp, to be perfectly honest, it's not plain to me where that kind of power and energy existed. If it existed at all, it existed inside the heads of Boris Johnson and Michael Gove, because they're the only two real intellectuals
exactly.
in the movement. And both of those excluded themselves. So the whole thing ground to a halt with her. She never had a chance once they turned on her, and essentially they just snuffed her out and left this other one, who is the establishment candidate. And it doesn't really matter whether she has an ideology. She probably doesn't. If she presents herself as being more socially liberal, which seems to be what she's saying, well, that's not new, because Cameron was socially liberal. There is nothing new in the progressive centre. It's going to carry on governing through her. The question is, how will they deal with Brexit?
Oh, how will they deal with it?
How will they now deal with that? That
the
is
challenge,
their problem.
Which is the challenge which is in front of them is to portray themselves as not being more of the same, though, because if they
exactly.
were to do that, then it means that they're going to get defeated
right.
at the next general election
right.
by Labour, who are already planning, if they can actually get rid of the problem of Jeremy Corbyn or Angela Eagle or whoever it is they're going to be with. You know, they need to make themselves look like they're doing something which is new and different. And so what I'm anticipating, this is a prediction, it could be a prediction, it will eventually be found to be wrong, because I'm wrong sometimes, but I'm predicting that the Theresa May premiership will be one where she's not going to just be, you know, more of the socially liberal that already exists and is mainstream presently, because that would just have people yawning. She's going to have to become a full communitarian. And by this, what do I mean? Communitarian is a person who is going to be dealing not just with, let's talk about, you know, markets all day long. She's going to be constantly talking about community, community engagement, rebuilding local communities, etc., etc. She's going to try to do what David Cameron did with this big society business, except not have it be all a lie, I guess. Because if it turns out to be another lie, then, of course, obviously she's finished.
It must do. The differences in race and ethnicity can never be papered over. Never.
I agree.
Never.
Exactly.
And no matter how much you talk about, you know, how peaceful Islam is and how together we must be, you know, how diversity strengthens us.
She's going to have to stop doing
it. It is still untrue.
That is why I'm seeing now there's a new publication that the Fabians have brought out. Yes, I do read them on occasion to find out what's going on inside their brains. Yeah. Their new approach, and I place this in huge quotation marks because their new approach seems like common sense. Their new approach is, as you just said, ironically, to stop pretending that communities are all the same and engage communities where they are at in the different challenges which they are experiencing.
Right, so
and the communities which are vulnerable to extremism need to be challenged strongly in order to give an impression that there is a competence and a strength.
And who is the author of
the way that these things begin?
Nick Cohen?
Some bunch of Fabians. I will give you a...
Can you give me their names?
Hold on, hold a second. Oh, it's actually the whole book. So I'll give you all of the names of the persons who have published this. It's their book called Future Lefts by Andrew Harrop, Ed Wallace, Rachel Lawrence, Lisa Nandy MP, Dan Jarvis MP, Harvey Redgrave, Claire McNeil, Kate Henderson, Polly Billington, Keir Starmer, Martin O'Neill, Roxana Fias, and Ed Wallace. I just gave his name already, so that's a repeat.
Okay, I know about six of those. These are not thinkers, with one possible exception, but they're basically not thinkers. One of them is a future leader of the party. If the party can find its way out of its present travail, and that's Dan Jarvis. And he could, in fact, do a job of appealing to the electorate as a whole.
That's the one name that sounds Jewish to me.
He's not Jewish. He's a former... Special Services, I think. He's quite a character.
Yeah, something like this.
And I think he has leadership potential.
I'll tell you which subject he was writing on in this book. Dan Jarvis wrote the section of this book that's called, quote, On Growing Up. So I'm assuming that he's talking about the children issue in that particular section, in the chapter that he's devoted to. The person who's writing on migration is Harvey Redgrave, and the person who wrote on national identity is Roxana Fias.
And I don't know that. But, I mean, obviously Roxana Fias is an Asian, I presume. But if you want to have something intelligent said about national identity, then you have to ask a nationalist. What's the point of somebody pretending that there is a national identity in a multiracial dispensation? How can there ever be a single identity when there are multiple races? We are not a society of values, the Brownite idea that we are all joined together by common values. No, we're not. So the issue really always comes back to, well, who's right on this soil? Who has right here? And I'm afraid there's only one people that have the right, and that is the native people, and all the others are...
Yes, I can tell you for sure now. Yeah, Roxana Fias is a South Asian.
Right.
Possibly from Pakistan originally,
okay,
but she
okay.
seems to be saying that you've got to stop the extremism, etc., etc.
Yeah, well, you know, this is all very nice, but it's only bien pensant stuff, isn't it? It's not going to have any effect at all in the real world. You cannot change sociobiology. You cannot change ethnicity. You cannot change the competitiveness which exists between groups. You cannot change the relationship of the colonized and the colonizer. The whole of politics as it's conducted today is simply an attempt to deny the suzerainty of this fact, because they don't have the courage to face the fact. To face the fact, you've got to say, well, for the last nearly seven decades now, we've been committing a crime against the native people of this land.
Yeah.
Goodness
me, it does seem to
we've
be,
done that. It's our fault, you know?
Yeah, there does seem to be some mild suggestions from them that they think that something had gone fundamentally wrong. But getting them to actually say literally it was they themselves who did it, That's the thing which is problematic. Well, they're unlikely to say this. I'll open the thing and see because I remember the section. So I'll see if I can just jump to the section and read the section which I think is an indication that they're aware. Because whether they'll actually say it to the people is a different thing. But among themselves, it seems that they must be aware. Otherwise, they wouldn't be writing this in the first place. Right, on the issue of individualism, I'm just quoting from the intro section of the book. Technology is creating opportunities for control and choice as the age of hierarchy, standardization, and scale is supplanted by horizontal networks, collaboration, and personalization. But the digital revolution is also giving rise to new concentrations of power and risks of exploitation, with our economic lives becoming more atomized, commoditized, and fragile. In this age of individuality, people face more complexity, instability, and risk, as well as greater freedom. This has serious consequences for pay and the quality of work. In the future, if there is no workplace organization to bid up wages or long-term sectoral partnerships to redesign occupations around skilled work, then rates of pay will stagnate, and the middle of the labor market will contract further. There are even those who predict that a radical new wave of automation might destroy more jobs than it creates. This would imply an end to full employment, to upward pressure on wages, and hence to rising domestic consumption, the usual driver of British economic growth. As collective risk-sharing institutions decline, people seem to be becoming more individualistic. The British today have a strong sense of personal responsibility, but also rising expectations about others and weakening of social deference. Of course, they mean deference to themselves. The latter often takes the form of healthy skepticism about economic and political elites, but is also tipping over into populist contempt, which, on a political level, is reflected in the rise of Farageism and Corbynism. The collapse of trust in politics as a vehicle for improving people's lives is now itself a major barrier to achieving our change.
Yeah, well,
and so it continues to go down. And where is the part where they mention this migration problem?
It's further in that passage down, Kimiko. What they're doing is basically they're saying, well, there's something that might not be entirely helpful to us, but it's just a development of other factors. It's not something that we've had any role in generating ourselves, because all of this is just the result of technology or something called individualism and so on and so forth, so that they're able to push away into these strange phenomena any responsibility.
Here's the identity
they may
part. And so I'll read just their politics of identity section, which is supposed to be a kind of like a preview of what they're going to argue in the book. So they have here the politics of identity. Politics is out of touch with people's lives. That's a nonsensical statement, of course, but they will continue. Trust in politicians is declining. The distance between elector and elected is widening, and authenticity and conviction seem to be in short supply in our professionalized political culture. In part, this stems from the way we practice politics, and that must radically change. But it also arises from the social forces sweeping through society, which pose particular challenges for the left. With communities becoming more diverse, deference on the wane, and the main route into positions of leadership being universities and not workplaces, it has become very hard for social democrats to really be tribunes of the people. Let me go on. In the second half of the 20th century, the left's politics took community for granted. It reflected an industrial age of scale and homogeneity, and was characterized by uniform, nationwide, and impersonal collective action. Inadvertently, other pre-1945 traditions based on smaller-scale self-organizing forms of collectivism were swamped. Cooperation, municipalism, guild socialism. Now that we cannot take old social bonds for granted, a new politics of identity must again nurture and cherish solidarity and collectivism in people's everyday lives. This means encouraging collective autonomous institutions and resisting the temptation to always intervene with national policy tools. Lastly, many people also sense that the moral intuitions of social democrats are not the same as theirs. We seem only to value care, fairness, and liberation, while most people actually also honor loyalty, authority, and sanctity, to use the lexicon of the US academic Jonathan Haidt. In context of rapid social change and an increasingly elderly population, the left has been too dismissive of people's anxieties and aspirations with respect to security, tradition, and the non-material dimensions of life. We must not sacrifice our old values, but we need to show we share all these dimensions of morality that people hold dear, and in particular, find new confidence to talk about family, patriotism, and immigration. politics, demand fundamental organizational and cultural change within political parties so they speak with conviction and work alongside communities and civic society, embrace an approach to politics focused on institutions and communities, not on policy levers, investigate reforms to democratic institutions to bring politicians closer to people's lives, then they have place, adopt radical and coherent devolution of money, responsibility and democracy to cities and counties with strong sense of community, lead debates with confidence on what English identity is, and be open-minded about future England-wide and regional governance. And then immigration, they have here as their final point, make credible promises on managed migration, including lower annual migration than today. Work with employers to make them less dependent on migrant labor and exploitative employment relationships, and take a tough approach to integration focused on the responsibilities of newcomers. And that's where they end off.
Right.
Obviously, it is not perfect. It's still actually horrendous in various ways, but it shows that they are aware of the discontent which exists out there.
Mm. Yes.
And you're suggesting that Theresa May is somewhat influenced by this?
Not directly, but what you have to...
Of course, because they all meet in the centre, but they're not directly influenced. No. But she's tending in that direction, because they're all influenced by it by third hand, because obviously she's not going to literally read from...
They haven't got too many places to go. What the meaning of these kinds of... contemplation of the political navel? The meaning of all of this is that they just don't know what to do. It's an admission of failure, and they have been trying for 2 decades to find some way to actually resolve the problem somehow. And the left does manage to have a life of the mind. This is one of the principal differences between left and right. And
they do
think hard. They do agonize about this business of finding an ideology, of finding an answer, finding something. They do try.
Well, you're treating the left as a found object, and what you're finding is something that's been submitted by Jews.
Fabianism is not a Jewish movement. Absolutely not.
Yeah,
Fabianism was very much a white people's thing, which essentially was adopted by South Asia.
But it's not okay.
The subtlety of the situation.
Then it's a left of other people.
Even Nehru adopted elements of Fabian socialism, and he didn't seem to have a problem with it. Obviously, he had many flaws in and of himself, because he parked India inside of basically a pretty ridiculous situation as a result. But this thing was not the preserve or the planning of Jewish minds of any sort. The original people who came out with that were what was his name? Russell Webb, Pearson. Pearson, for example, was another guy who contributed to Fabianism, because he was a what do they call those people? A coefficient. And then that fed into Fabianism as well. And Pearson, in Pearson's case, he was literally a white supremacist. I mean, obviously the Fabian Society was a society where they brought people together and thinking occurred. And, it was kind of revisionist thinking from a Marxist perspective. The Marxists didn't like what they were doing because it looked like revisionism, and it was.
Yeah.
And then...
But it was incrementalism. Wait a minute.
Incremental socialism.
So you're admitting that it was from a Marxist... It began with a Marxist...
No, it didn't. It was done in opposition to that. But you're not allowing
Indeed.
For the fact is that the Fabian Society attempted to introduce a... process towards socialism that was incremental in form and
not
revolutionary.
That is the purpose. You're right about that.
That is why it stands in contradistinction to Marxism within the movement, the broad left movement in this country.
And of course, we all know the famous quotes. U.S. wars Fabian did, because Fabian waited most patiently. But if you do not strike when the time has come, then everything you have done will be in vain and fruitless, which is where that other quote comes from: when I strike hard. That's what they're waiting for.
Well,
they're trying
to
create particular circumstances under which socialism could then be implemented. All of this argument that was happening when Gaitskell was having that argument with... who was the person opposed to Gaitskell? Gaitskell was on the right of the Labour Party. Who was opposed to him again?
Bevan, probably. You're thinking
Bevan, that's right. Bevan versus Gaitskell.
Right,
all of
Jewish
that
name.
was not a discussion of what the fundamental direction of the party was going to be, but rather the argument between Gaitskell and Bevan was what is the correct method to eventually achieve the result. They never disagreed on the final outcome, as far as I can be aware.
No.
Or what the final outcome is supposed to be. So if they don't end up in socialism, it's only by accident they do not end there. if they do end up in socialism, then that is their intent.
If they're not organizing this socialism on the basis of serving the native English, then according to my concept, I would call it an anti-white. I might call it an anti-white left, but I just wouldn't call it the left.
Well,
I know there's somebody. I know it can be done. You can hear what GW is saying and assume that he means these things. Understood.
But it became a car crash eventually because of the fact that obviously it became very, very, very liberalized, as you all know, because we've all lived in an era in which the Labour Party is essentially doing liberalism at present. So to say that the Fabian Society is producing socialism does not mean that I'm denying there's a car crash presently ongoing. The car crash is indeed ongoing.
You do agree that liberalism is something different than leftism?
Of course.
But my own view on this, for what it's worth, is that liberalism, in fact, has a much broader application to human life and human personality than politics, and that it actually affects the kinds of human personality which are enculturated within it. It's a conditioning environment. Within that, as politics, it has a number of strands, some of which are revolutionary and were taken over by Marxist thought, but not all revolutionary thought is Marxist, and some of which are more democratic. The whole question of how these settle in relation to what is known broadly as the political left is certainly available for debate, but all of it, to me, all of it, in one kind or another, is liberalism, because all of it comes from the same general tradition, which one could date back to the English Civil War thinkers, and all of it, in one form or another, leads eventually to the unfettered will.
I would, if you were referring to these, if you're using the word liberal instead of left, we would not be having these altercations.
No, but by just saying, to me, liberalism has a totalistic, ruling relation to the way that we as modern Westerners arise. I don't regard us as being affected in that way by Marxism, for example. And I don't regard us as being affected in that way by economism or neoliberalism or whatever you want to take from the right. But we are all the children, to quote Marx, we are all Hobbes's children, he said. But I mean, perhaps Locke.
Well, I interpreted GW's use of the word left in this context as correct, because when you're talking about the Fabian Society and we had just pre-acknowledged that their ultimate aim is to try to construct a form of socialism, non-Marxian in their case, but a form of socialism nonetheless, then it is not inaccurate to have referred to them as the left, even if what they are presently doing is a car crash, which is actually liberalism and not the left, to refer to them as, to refer to the organization which is supposed to be planning this thing as being a leftist organization is not incorrect.
It's not incorrect. I agree that it's not incorrect to use the word left there, but it has to be qualified. What kind of left? Then I would call it the Fabian left. How about that?
They would say that themselves, actually. Yeah,
indeed they would. Going to come on to talk about next what is happening in UKIP. We should understand first of all that UKIP is only ever going to develop a civic response as it is currently formulated, because everybody who is inside that party is fundamentally either a civic nationalist or a libertarian.
Yeah, literally a libertarian. Do you remember the one that UKIP was, how they had, so I think it was one of their youth leader directors or something like this, and they had put to him the question. It was very similar, because I remember it was very similar to the question that they'd put to the Muslim Brotherhood, and they had given the wrong response to this question as well. And the question was, do you think that it's inappropriate for a human being to have sex with a deceased person?
Oh, and the libertarians couldn't answer that, presumably.
Exactly. The UKIP libertarians had immense difficulty responding to this, because the first thing was, is this a trap question? If you have to ask that, you're probably in trouble already. Yeah, and then, they could not come up with an answer.
And libertarians also come, The libertarians also come from the Austrian school too, from the Hayek and von Mises and
yes. But I do remember that was very, very, very funny because they could not come with an answer. So whichever journalist it was who thought of that question, that person's a genius because that was a trap question, bar none.
Yeah. UKIP is having a little debate at the moment, which is about who can stand as leader. Now, there are a number of people who have put their hats sort of nearly in the ring, but there's no ring as such at the moment. They're not acting with the same dispatch that the Conservative Party acted in this process. So there's some debate now about who, in fact, qualifies to be able to stand. And they seem to be saying, or the NEC, it has an NEC, a National Executive Committee, seems to be considering the possibility that it will institute a retrospective five-year membership rule for leaders, that if you haven't been a member for 5 years, you cannot join. So this knocks out Peter Whittle, for example, who stood as the mayoral candidate for UKIP for London in May. He cannot stand as party leader. Aaron Banks, who's the principal funder of the party at the moment and who put a great deal of money into Brexit and won, and he can't stand. He was interviewed, incidentally, on BBC on Sunday morning and stated that he might be seeking to start a new party if UKIP can't be steered in the direction that he wants. Rahim Kassam, he can't do it because Rahim wasn't a member 5 years ago. It's a little bit difficult to see who there is who was a member 5 years ago. Who would actually qualify for this process? Possibly Stephen Wolfe, I don't know.
Yes, that's what I was going to ask you. Is this just a setup so that Stephen Wolfe gets the nomination
then?
It may
be that he's the only one standing. But, I mean, who the hell is there in the party from 5 years ago who's competent enough to become leader today?
It's
as
no
if
laws.
Nothing has changed. You know,
can I just briefly comment on UKIP? It should be no laws. This is a party founded on the objectivism of the Austrian school as well.
Yep.
And this is a based on Wittgenstein's Tractatus. And to elaborate a little bit more on what Heidegger was trying to do with his postmodern turn was to take the relationship of knower to known into praxis. And praxis is what you are calling existentialism, which is the correct position to base a nationalist platform on. But I just wanted to make that point. But there is a place to go in argumentative contrast to UKIP, and this would be a false opposition, much like Ron Paul was sort of being used for the capitalist interests.
I don't think capitalism would involve itself with UKIP until such time as UKIP became a genuine threat to the establishment's parties. At that point, of course, it will be co-opted, and the people in it will be corrupted. But at the moment, you know, you've got to look at them and say, well, we've got so much uncertainty attached to the main parties. Is UKIP in a position where it could actually break through? Because people will be saying, I've had enough, I'm cancelling my membership, and you know, Labour has got Corbyn, or this woman who's trying to get control of the party at the moment off him, who's absolutely no better. You know, I can't support them. It's going to be UKIP. I've got to find somebody at the very least who I can protest through. So they do have that positional advantage, which the BNP never achieved. I mean, let's be clear about this. It's something I've said before. The BNP is a nationalist party under Griffin. It got close, but it never made the jump to warp speed. It couldn't do it. But UKIP did do that.
Part of the reason for that is well, tell me if you think I'm wrong about this. Part of the reason for that is BNP's unfortunate association. Unfortunate for them, of course. Association which seemed to have been drawn in the public's mind between themselves Combat 18 and the National Front, because they think that many of the persons involved are the same persons who were involved in those things back then. And there's kind of this, like, you know, ooh, spooky.
That sounds to me a bit like an insider's view, Kimiko. I think the basic difficulty with the BNP was the very low grade of people who were willing to brave the rocks and spitting and, you know, general aggression of the left. You have to remember that back in the 1980s, the National Front was trying to perform this function, and they did very well for a very short time. And then the left actually launched a war on the streets. And this was...
Which left did that?
I would say the revolutionary left.
Anarchists and... Yeah, anarchists and...
Anarchists,
yeah.
And there was there was a very vicious physical war fought in which... the numbers were on the side of the attacking left, and the National Front people found themselves also confronted with being fitted up. I know Troy Southgate, for example, spent time inside on a charge which he insists to this day was totally manufactured.
The reason that they were not saved by the state, because sometimes, you know, during the times of Gladio and so on, you would have tried to save them because of the fact that you would need them just in case the Soviet Union did something, et cetera, et cetera. So the reason the state never actually came to stop this violence is because by the time it was the late 80s and the early 90s, the Soviet Union had fallen. And so there was no need for any covert support to be directed toward these people either, right, if they were getting any in the first place. There would have been no incentive for them to have been rescued by law enforcement when this war started.
Griffin brought
Even
it to an end.
Even if it was prosecuted against them.
Griffin brought it all to an end because he left... And he joined, and so did others, but joined what was then a startup called the BNP, and he managed to grab the leadership of it, and he absolutely said, we're not going to conduct this on the streets. We're not going to march. Yeah. We're going to organize on a constituency level. And this was pretty much how they began their process of growth, and it worked. When they got to a certain point in 2009 that they began
And then it got
to,
jammed off.
Then it got and Griffin himself pulled the house in about it. So
yes, that's what I was going to say. That their growth coincided with Griffin, although he avoided the street politics thing.
Yeah.
People remembered that from before anyway, and would always try to tar him with it, and he'd kind of, like, you know, evade out of it and then, you know, do all these evasions and so on.
Yeah.
But the major problem was the way in which he ran the party was that he ended up with a collection of sycophants around him with no self-criticism allowed at all. And so anytime they would make an incorrect decision, it would be made 1,000% in that direction with no pushback.
Mm. There were able
and that
people,
continued
but
until
they never got
various
to the,
people
they never
left.
Got to the central clique. They got
they got to
organize locally. I mean, I know one or two who were very able people who would have been fine members of the, you know, any national executive of any political party. But the bottom line is they were never able to get close to real control in the party. That was completely retained by Griffin. And, of course, the whole thing came apart. But to get back to where I was, I mean, the point is that for one reason or another, the pathologization of the party was allowed to proceed. And the way that the party was run only attracted that kind of treatment from the press. So, you know, there was never a possibility, really, that they would be able to turn themselves into a genuine mass movement party. They did, however... poll a reasonable number of votes in the European elections of 2009, something getting on towards a million votes, I think. About 950,000 odd. So they did achieve that, and that was as far as it went. And very, very quickly, it came apart.
This is just one of the facets, because obviously, you know, a diamond has many facets. One of the facets that stuck out to me in terms of their narrative problem was that the press was very, very strident about catching them in narrative problems that stretch from 1945 until about the mid-90s.
Well, the obvious
trap... If Nick Griffin had dumped the Churchill nonsense, just don't defend Churchill.
The Holocaust. You know, he'd at some point during his younger years, when he was a bit more idealistic and simple-minded, He'd written a book called The Mind Benders, and he'd been a Holocaust denier as well.
Oh dear. Oh dear.
You know, to use a famous phrase they like so much. And of course, you know, on the great QT debacle program, the very first question that came out of the audience, cued by David Dimbleby, was from a little boy. Oh, he's about 13 or 14, and there he was with his kippah on his head, you know, asking this carefully phrased question, obviously written by his uncle or his granddad. You know, lo and behold, right from the beginning, there was Griffin having to say, well, I made a mistake when I said XYZ about, you know. And he couldn't, as a politician, he couldn't in modernity, you know, he couldn't possibly say anything at all that was going to make his situation better. So, you know, you'd have to say, if it was any other party, you don't elect somebody with that kind of baggage, of that kind of weakness in political discourse against your enemies. You don't elect that person to, you don't expose them to danger, you don't elect them to a position of leadership.
Particularly if they have a whole book about it, particularly if they had written a whole book about it, because then that book can be quote mined infinitely. Every page is going to be, a cornucopia for them.
Yeah, well, I mean, the correct way to deal with questions from Jews is to return them with a question. You know, what do you think the British people have got to do, the native British people have got to do to secure their existence and a future for their children in this land? As a Jew, what do you think we've got to do? If you turn
exactly,
that back,
they can't answer that
they
question.
Can't answer
yeah, they
that.
Can't answer that question.
I mean, you know, and you should say, if jury thinks that we must do nothing, then you give me that answer. If jury thinks we must do something, then you're on my side, and we don't have to argue. That's the end of it. But he didn't say that.
And of course, he'd be able to say that with the advantage of knowing that they're never going to give the answer that would make them quote unquote on his side, because inherently they will not do that.
They will not do that.
It's not in their interest to make that argument, so they won't.
So they're struck dumb, and they can't say to the world, well, we don't want you to do that, or oh, we believe in you continuing down this road, and we don't give a damn about you.
Yeah, the only nationalistic opinion that you'll usually find coming out of the mouths of British Jews is going to be
about
ones
Jews.
Which are... Yeah. About Israel, of course, because they're very fiercely
exceptions.
Defensive of Israel.
I have seen Jews being
critical of Israel.
Competent spokesman for British nationalism. I mean, there was one fellow who did that, a fellow called Lawrence Rustam, who worked hard up to 2010 for the BNP, and who was a passionate believer in it. And his reason for doing it, funnily enough, was not to get control of the narrative, of opposing narratives, or anything like that.
Of course.
In his case, he was.
Yeah, when I say that, I don't mean
he was beaten up very badly.
Yeah, when I say that, I don't mean 100% either. No. I mean it's obviously a statistical unlikelihood. So I don't mean that every single one of them would give the same response.
No.
But you can go on the assumption, because there's a statistical unlikelihood that they're going to deliver the response that you wanted to hear.
But it isn't impossible to answer these questions. Under the pressure of the spotlights, with the audience breathing on you, you know, the sweat on your brow and the sense that you're trapped coming upon you, obviously it's very, very difficult. And it's easy for me sitting here just to spout off a few things. But, you know, I am not party leader, and had I been there on that occasion, I would have prepared myself for everything. And knowing that I was going in there to be a sacrificial lamb. But, you know, it's history.
Yeah.
He completely failed. The movement was very angry with him for failing so badly. It proved to be a full stop to the development of the party, and thereafter he was involved in a war which he won by pulling down the roof of the party on his own head. And now, what are they? And now, what is nationalism? Sitting back here, you know, talking about these things, thinking that UKIP might offer some potential for us to move forward, or some vehicle by which we might perhaps obtain some good results, as was occurred with Brexit and the referendum. But, you know, it's a disaster story.
Well, what
said
is
that,
the present? What is What is the present goal what is the present goal that we're looking toward? We've got the Brexit thing in the cards. It's very unlikely that they will fail to raise Article 50. So we're all in agreement on that. So what would you think the next step is, and why would it be UKIP that would take us there, as opposed to, like, I don't know, some other faction of the presently existing group?
Well, I think that the first thing to understand about nationalism is that it has been splintered into 1,000 parts. It's a bit like the splintering of a planet in space. It's probable that, you know, there are planets in some solar systems which get splintered regularly. Then over the aeons, you know, gravity brings all the pieces back together again, and forces produce friction, and friction produces heat, and the planet comes to life with a powerful core developing movement, and some singularity appears, and something flies out of space, smashes it to bits again. Nationalism is currently in many pieces, and the pieces are very disassociated from each other, and currently they're each trying to vie with each other and to develop their own identity, so they're still moving away from each other. That's the stage that we're in at the moment. And if we're to turn that around, it has to begin with all of the people who have ambitions to be leaders. You know, Paul Goldring, for example, at Britain First, Paul Weston, Liberty GB, all of the people who are involved in this in one way or another need to be brought back together and need to find an organizational unity and need to have the capacity to agree to speak with one voice. Then you have a movement again, and that would have some potential in our present time, not least because of the great uncertainty that is inflicting all the major parties and has now overtaken UKIP. So, yes, I think that this is a period of great opportunity. No, I don't think that nationalism as a body is in any fit condition to take advantage of it. But that is a different thing from our ability to influence the way that conversation proceeds generally in the nation. We have very weak foundations. We operate in chief through the threads of newspapers and on websites, but we have some force all the same, and this force does not affect the establishment at this point. They're not bothered at all, but we do have some influence. I can be certain of this because I have observed the way that threat activism and the nationals and so forth gradually moves towards us, and I've also observed the way in which arguments which I've seen become popular since MR was set up, existentialist arguments in part, identitarian arguments, arguments in natural right, have proved impossible for the left to handle. And sorry about that, Daniel, but I mean,
That is the left.
People, yes, the Jewish left. So, I do think that we have an influence, and I do think that we have to work very hard and not give up. And I do think that this is a slightly better time for thinking nationalism than it is for political nationalism, that's for sure. But that's where we are.
Well, people are a part of nature. I'll say that. So the idea of looking at a social group and its patterns is not anti-nature either.
Nope. No, it's very simple to argue. You know, the demand for life, which is fundamentally what it is unanswerable by anybody. By anybody. Nobody can tell you that your people do not have the right to struggle for life. They can't do that. And it always comes down to that principle in the end.
Yeah, it always comes down to that. That you don't have the right to live, for example. Mm. That's what they're essentially saying when they tell you, no, you need to stand down immediately. You can find it all over the place. It comes in many different guises. Mm. Many different guises they'll bring it under. The reason I'm able to so recognize it in this British context is because of the fact that I've seen it in so many other contexts. for instance, in a third world context, the narrative they usually use to get you to stand down is to tell you that, you know, violence is bad, or, you know, if you're acting up too much, you'll be construed as racist, so on and so forth. And so, you know, you need to stand down and let the international community solve your problems for you. And of course, by that, they mean lie down and be stepped upon. Because the international community does not exist, at least not in the way that people think it does. The international community means basically multinational institutions, the IMF, the World Bank, and whoever happens to have a lot of money at that point in time and have an interest in what you're doing. And so if you don't assert yourself, then those people just get automatic right to do whatever they want to you, which may or may not be bad depending on the situation. Usually it's bad though. And so the same thing applies in the first world as well. I think that British people should not forget that. That, you know, this niceness which we are allegedly presently enjoying may not be nice for very much longer if everyone were to stand down and never actually engage in anything political. If everyone just did nothing, the side which does something would continue doing things.
As we've just seen, in fact, with the Leadsom and May affair. I mean, the establishment is just doing things, isn't it? It's just rolling on. And, you know, when you look at them, I see today, or was it yesterday, Goldman Sachs hired Manuel Barroso, former Marxist, and...
Jose Manuel Barroso,
that's him.
I used to think that he was all right until I realized what was going on with this Goldman thing, because the reason why he implemented these rules in the European Commission, that you couldn't do it until 5 years had passed or something like this, was not to stop the corruption per se, but to give you just enough time that everyone had forgotten about what you had done before you reappear as a lobbyist. That's the reason for it. And so I think that he always had a relationship with them, and it shows a real... It shows a real distance that he has travelled, because, you know, in his youth days he was a Maoist, and yes, then, you know, he moved on and he became the president of I guess you could say a conservative government in Portugal. I guess you can say, you know, the best people for doing capitalism are people who have been communists, because I guess you understand capitalism better if you've been a communist. He was very good at what he did there, and then he moved on and became part of became essentially the leader of the European Commission. Yep. And he was the one who coined these beautiful, wonderful phrases about how, you know, the European Union is an undefined political object, and that, you know, we're like 11 players on a football team, we're all coming together. And, you know, the European Union is the first time that everyone has agreed to pool their sovereignty. It has the dimension of empire. He was also the guy who was a strong advocate of eliminating duplication among the defense sector across the continent. So he was a presage of this European army that no one was talking about at that time, because you weren't supposed to acknowledge that it existed or it was coming into existence. But it existed back when he was, it was a thing back when he was actually commissioner. Everyone was kind of like, you know, preparing for this thing. It's easy to talk about it now because now everyone knows it was coming. But back then, when Barroso was talking about, you know, harmonization of defense sector across the continent, that was because everyone who was having that conversation actually knew the goal was an EU army. Like, I knew that back then. It's just that you don't say this. So, you know, he was excellent in terms of his ability to take on a task, manage it, and then, you know, present it very jovially to the media. Like, you know, this is all wonderful. I'm a wonderful person. Aren't we all wonderful people? We should all just go along with this. And so, you know, a lot of people think that Barroso was like some kind of, like, you know, evil cancer or something. No, I did not have this view of him. He, how can I put this? Perhaps he was advocating views which were bad, but he did them very competently, unlike what these people are presently doing. So I think that had Barroso been in charge and not Juncker, for example, I think Barroso would have been resistant to having allowed this situation to happen. It would have still happened anyway, but he would have been resistant to it, because of the fact that he'd be able to sense that down the line, because he's been the head of an actual Conservative Party in his lifetime, he'd have been able to sense that down the line it would lead to an implosion of the entire project. And I think that his commitment to the project, which was in fact fanatical, his commitment to the project would have outweighed a couple million migrants any time of the day.
It's internationalist. I mean, you know, we won't do it today because we've got pretty much to the close, but, you know, we could debate at length on the moment at which the original conception of European Union itself turned into a globalist project. You know, when did it become a globalist project? Was it there from the beginning, or were there developments, say, in the 1970s and 80s, maybe, which gradually
which
meant
for it
that
to
it
be
became,
a model for the world.
Yeah, came from
yeah,
it,
I would
be
say
part
that
of
I...
this globalizing. I mean, where was globalism before, say, 1970s? I don't know.
Exactly. Very strange. And the thing about it is, I'd say that if we're going to try to find this, we should look, in terms of rhetoric at least, we should look for the moment that they began parading this phrase, the European Union is a model for the world. Whenever they started saying that was probably when it jumped the tracks, because initially it must have been a continental view that they had initially, because that was the whole purpose. Well, you would think that was the purpose.
Yeah.
But at some point, someone decided that actually it doesn't have any borders. It just it's nothing.
It's a process.
It's a process. It's not a thing.
The end result is the globality, in actual fact. So I mean, we just have to. Ask
even some writers,
when this actually happened.
When it happened. Even some writers in Eurofederalist magazines and so on had sort of foreshadowed a possibility that this question was going to become the central question of the survival of the European Union as an institution. The idea that if you cannot get a European patriotism, and if you cannot draw a line and define this is Europe, this is not Europe, and here is the concrete reason as to why that is so, then eventually it will come apart. They were warned about this. They were told that if they cannot define it, it will come apart. And someone had suggested, now I'll give you the name of the person afterwards, because obviously this is off topic, not part of this particular interview. But, you know, there was a particular person who had approached them, one of those intellectual types that everyone was, you know, very revering at that time, revering this individual. And he had approached them, and he had lectured them, I think it was in two separate books and an article, explaining to them that if Europe is not actually about the European peoples and a European agenda, it will one day implode, and you will not know the reason why, but it will be because you never defined it. And look, this is where we are now, isn't it?
Well, yeah, sure. But we're at a breaking point. You could say, I suppose, that not just the European Union, but the entire process of globalism, if we define that as a political project of internationalist elites, be they political or corporate and banking elites. So, you know, if you view the thing as a project of that kind and say, well, the EU is whatever it was at its beginning, and however it was idealized at the outset, the fact remains that it has become one of the processes, along with other processes of a similar kind in different parts of the world, that are being used, whether they've been prostituted for this reason or whether they've been designed for this reason.
So you can see it at an institutional level as well.
You can see
particularly in the and in the ECB specifically, I would say that you could see that happening. After the 2008 crisis, what was the ECB's response? To make Europeans basically eat dirt. What was the ECB's response when migrants showed up at the border? To shell money out to them. Very, very strange behavior. Mm. What, am I breaking up or am I still
here? No, you just disappeared very quickly. You're okay.
Okay. A comparison I would make between the ECB on the one hand and, let's say, the Asian Development Bank on the other hand, is a clause which exists in the Asian Development Bank, which may or may not at one point have existed in the ECB, but I cannot find it there now. Okay? In the Asian Development Bank, there is a clause in the founding constitution of that bank which says that it may not dilute its essential Asian character. In other words, you cannot appoint people into the Asian Development Bank who do not have the interests of Asia at heart, and you cannot have a proportion of members sitting on the board who are not Asian, who exceed a certain percentage. You know, even if you're you know, open to any kind of person, at this point, once you reach the highest apex of finance, you should, national security is connected to this kind of thing, you should question the kind of persons who you are hiring. I don't think it would be unreasonably, to use this term, quote, racist, unreasonably racist, to question the motivations of persons hiring at a central bank, particularly one of the European Union size.
No.
And the major problem, of course, with asking these questions is that in the European context, if you start asking these questions at that kind of level, then you're going to be turning aside a lot of people who, I guess you could say, would live in Israel if it were not for the fact that they happen to be in Europe. Let me just put it that way, diplomatically. And so, you know, this becomes a real problem because, like, what would you even say to them at this point? Like, how, if you were to actually, you know, talk about an essential European character in the European Central Bank.
Are you asking what I would say to them if I could write law?
Yeah, yes, of course. What would you say to them at this point? Because, of course, they're going to present themselves as being essentially European, except when they're not. So what would you do/say to them?
Well, to start with, I wouldn't exclude anybody on the basis of race or religion. I would be looking to find some way of determining what their basic interests were, and once I'd found out what those were, then I would be looking to exclude them if they were not consonant with ours. I mean, that's the way I would operate it. So, for example, as the managing director of Majority Rights, you know, this huge website, which obviously has got a vast staff catering for its many, many customers 24/7, I would be saying to this Japanese lady, you know, who presented a tremendous CV, what's your principles here? What's your reason for wanting to come to us? You know, what do you think that you can achieve for your customers? And if I didn't get from you the right answer, look, I'm a radical nationalist. This place is an obvious place for me to come and work, and I am an obvious candidate to work for you. You know, if I didn't get that, I would start to wonder whether you were actually operating from some fundamental basis that was not particularly condign from our point of view. How do you do that in a corporate environment so that you eliminate?
Exactly.
That's the trick. Well, at the moment, you know, one manages to do this with political parties quite easily. You know, political parties, by and large, do not take on board people who don't have political interests of the party at heart.
Exactly. Well said. Well said.
So, I mean, I don't see that it is too difficult to introduce an ethnic and nationalist, not regime as such, but certainly culture into a business.
Yeah.
Whereby they can actually, you know, make these distinctions. And as I've tried to say during the course of this conversation and before we started talking, there is no exclusion of people who have something to contribute if it's substantial and in good heart and helpful. If they're not, in fact, one of our own people. That's not how it operates, even
exactly
in nationalist parties. So I can't see why on earth this wouldn't apply in businesses. This should be open to people, but not to those who are operating another agenda. Simple as that.
Exactly. That's well said. That's precisely the kind of answer I was looking for. That is basically how you would, objectively speaking, maintain an essential character which is conducive to your interests. Not necessarily by saying, oh, well, only people of this particular physical appearance can get by the bar, but rather saying it depends on what you're trying to accomplish.
Yes.
So that way you'd get some people who are, quote, diverse, but you wouldn't end up with, like, you know, a total inability to screen people.
No. Well, I mean, I think the important thing is that, you know, in the end, the values which one's trying to instill are universal values. They're universal human values. And whilst healthy-minded people can agree on those universal human values and cooperate on the basis of those universal human values, these are not universalizing values. That is the limit, and that's the crossover. So we're talking about a belief in human beauty and difference and human interest, which we all jointly and severally hold. The jointly holding of the beliefs means that we work for each other's peoples, in so much as we keep ourselves distinct. And that is the fundamental value. It is a universal
value.
Well said. And I wouldn't want to see myself involved or anybody really involved in a organization which sought the opposite values, such as any of the global banks or corporations. Anyway, there
well
we
said.
Go. And there we go. These things aren't impossible to solve. They require a minimum of thought by anybody who really understands the way the ground is laid out. You know, the world that would emerge from that would be a completely different world, and a beautiful world, not a world that was hostile to any people. Not hostile to anyone. Not hostile to Jews, nobody. But only hostile to the idea that it should not exist. And that's it. Anyway, there we go. I think we've done a lot of talking.
Well said.
Moved a hell of a long way
yes.
away from where we started. And I think probably as regards to the recording, we can call it a day there. Daniel, is there anything else you want to add to any of that?
I thought it was an excellent conversation. Really, I enjoyed that very much.
Yeah. Kimiko, is there anything else you want to raise before I stop recording?
No, nothing else. We can put a line under it.
Okay, thanks very much.